This is a CBS News special report. The debate over defense. Here is Dan Rather.
Good evening. President Reagan will address the nation shortly from the White House Oval Office. Subject, national security and defense spending. The president is expected to make a fleeting reference to the change of power in the Philippines, but for the most part, this address tonight is a planned, well-in-advance request for public support for increased U.S. defense spending. Privately, senior administration officials have been saying this will be a tough, bluntly worded address, an effort to reverse what even they see as dwindling public support for votes in Congress on any hefty military spending increases.
Highest duty as president, to preserve peace and defend these United States. But before I do, let me take a moment to speak about the situation in the Philippines. We've just seen a stirring demonstration of what men and women committed to democratic ideas can achieve. The remarkable people of those 7,000 islands joined together with faith in the same principles on which America was founded, that men and women have the right to freely choose their own destiny. Despite a flawed election, the Filipino people were understood. They carried their message peacefully, and they were heard across their country and across the world. We salute the remarkable restraint shown by both sides to prevent bloodshed during these last tense days. Our hearts and hands are with President Aquino and her new government as they set out to meet the challenges ahead. Today, the Filipino people celebrate the triumph of democracy, and the world celebrates with them. One cannot sit in this office reviewing intelligence on the military threat we face, making decisions from arms control to Libya to the Philippines, without having that concern for America's security weigh constantly on your mind. We know that peace is the condition under which mankind was meant to flourish. Yet peace does not exist of its own will. It depends on us, on our courage to build it and guard it and pass it on to future generations. George Washington's words may seem hard and cold today, but history has proven him right again and again. To be prepared for war, he said, is one of the most effective means of preserving peace. Well, to those who think strength provokes conflict, Will Rogers had his own answer. He said of the world heavyweight champion of his day, "I've never seen anyone insult Jack Dempsey." The past 5 years have shown that American strength is once again a sheltering arm for freedom in a dangerous world. Strength is the most persuasive argument we have to convince our adversaries to negotiate seriously and to cease bullying other nations. But tonight, the security program that you and I launched to restore America's strength is in jeopardy, threatened by those who would quit before the job is done. Any slackening now would invite the very dangers America must avoid and could fatally compromise our negotiating position. Our adversaries, the Soviets, we know from painful experience, respect only nations that negotiate from a position of strength. American power is the indispensable element of a peaceful world. It is America's last best hope of negotiating real reductions in nuclear arms. Just as we are sitting down at the bargaining table with the Soviet Union, let's not throw America's trump card away. We need to remember where America was 5 years ago. We need to recall the atmosphere of that time, the anxiety that events were out of control, that the West was in decline, that our enemies were on the march. It was not just the Iranian hostage crisis or the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, but the fear felt by many of our friends that America could not or would not keep her commitments. Pakistan, the country most threatened by the Afghan invasion, ridiculed the first offer of American aid as peanuts. Other nations were saying that it was dangerous, deadly dangerous, to be a friend of the United States. It was not just years of declining defense spending, but a crisis in recruitment and retention and the outright cancellation of programs vital to our security. The Pentagon horror stories at the time were about ships that couldn't sail, planes that couldn't fly for lack of spare parts, and army divisions unprepared to fight. And it was not just a one-sided arms agreement that made it easy for one side to cheat, but a treaty that actually permitted increases in nuclear arsenals. Even supporters of SALT II were demoralized, saying, well, the Soviets just won't agree to anything better. And when President Carter had to abandon the treaty because Senate leaders of his own party wouldn't support it, the United States was left without a national strategy for control of nuclear weapons. We knew immediate changes had to be made. So here's what we did. We set out to show that the long string of governments falling under communist domination was going to end. And we're doing it. In the 1970s, one strategic country after another fell under the domination of the Soviet Union. The fall of Laos, Cambodia, and South Vietnam gave the Soviet Union a strategic position on the South China Sea. The invasion of Afghanistan cut nearly in half Soviet flying time to the Persian Gulf. Communist takeovers in South Yemen and Ethiopia put the Soviets astride the Red Sea, entryway to the Suez Canal. Pro-Soviet regimes in Mozambique and Angola strengthened the Soviet position in southern Africa. And finally, Grenada and Nicaragua gave Moscow two new beachheads right on the doorstep of the United States. In these last 5 years, not one square inch of territory has been lost, and Grenada has been set free. When we arrived in 1981, guerrillas in El Salvador had launched what they called their final offensive to make that nation the second communist state on the mainland of North America. Many people said the situation was hopeless. They refused to help. We didn't agree. We did help. And today those guerrillas are in retreat. El Salvador is a democracy, and freedom fighters are challenging communist regimes in Nicaragua, Afghanistan, Angola, Cambodia, and Ethiopia. We set out to show that the Western alliance could meet its security needs despite Soviet intimidation, and we're doing it. Many said that to try to counter the Soviet SS-20 missiles would split NATO because Europe no longer believed in defending itself. Well, that was nonsense. Today, Pershing and cruise missile deployments are on schedule, and our allies support the decision. We set out to reverse the decline in morale in our armed forces, and we're doing it. Pride in our armed forces has been restored. More qualified men and women want to join and remain in the military. In 1980, about half of our Army's recruits were high school graduates. Last year, 91% had high school diplomas. Our armed forces may be smaller in size than in the 1950s, but they're some of the finest young people this country has ever produced. And as long as I'm president, they'll get the quality equipment they need to carry out their mission. We set out to narrow the growing gaps in our strategic deterrent, and we're beginning to do that. Our modernization program, the MX, the Trident submarine, the B-1, and stealth bombers, represents the first significant improvement in America's strategic deterrent in 20 years. Those who speak so often about the so-called arms race ignore a central fact. In the decade before 1981, the Soviets were the only ones racing. During my 1980 campaign, I called federal waste and fraud a national scandal. We knew we could never rebuild America's strength without first controlling the exploding cost of defense programs. And we're doing it. When we took office in 1981, costs had been escalating at an annual rate of 14%. Then we began our reforms, and in the last 2 years, cost increases have fallen to less than 1%. We've made huge savings. Each F-18 fighter costs nearly $4 million less today than in 1981. One of our air-to-air missiles costs barely half as much. Getting control of the defense bureaucracy is no small task. Each year, the Defense Department signs hundreds of thousands of contracts. So, yes, a horror story will sometimes turn up despite our best efforts. That's why we appointed the first inspector general in the history of the Defense Department, and virtually every case of fraud or abuse has been uncovered by our Defense Department, our inspector general. Secretary Weinberger should be praised, not pilloried, for cleaning the skeletons out of the closet. As for those few who have cheated taxpayers or have swindled our armed forces with faulty equipment, they are thieves stealing from the arsenal of democracy, and they will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Finally, we set out to reduce the danger of nuclear war. Here, too, we're achieving what some said couldn't be done. We've put forth a plan for deep reductions in nuclear systems. We're pushing forward our highly promising strategic defense initiative, a security shield that may one day protect us and our allies from nuclear attack, whether launched by deliberate calculation, freak accident, or the isolated impulse of a madman. Isn't it better to use our talents and technology to build systems that destroy missiles, not people? Our message has gotten through. The Soviets used to contend that real reductions in nuclear missiles were out of the question. Now they say they accept the idea. Well, we shall see. Just this week, our negotiators presented a new plan for the elimination of intermediate-range nuclear missiles. And we're pressing the Soviets for cuts in other offensive forces as well. One thing is certain. If the Soviets truly want fair and verifiable agreements that reduce nuclear forces, we will have those agreements. Our defense problems 5 years ago were immense, and drastic action was required. Even my predecessor in this office recognized that and projected sizable increases in defense spending, and I'm proud of what we've done. Now, the biggest increases in defense spending are behind us. And that's why last summer I agreed with Congress to freeze defense funding for 1 year, and after that to resume a modest 3% annual growth. Frankly, I hesitated to reach this agreement on a freeze because we still have far too much to do. But I thought that congressional support for steady increases over several years was a step forward. But this didn't happen. Instead of a freeze, there was a sharp cut, a cut of over 5%. And some are now saying that we need to chop another $20, $30, or even $50 billion out of national defense. This is reckless, dangerous, and wrong. It's backsliding of the most irresponsible kind, and you need to know about it. You, after all, paid the bill for all we've accomplished these past 5 years. But we still have a way to go. Millions of Americans actually believe that we are now superior to the Soviet Union in military power. Well, I'm sorry, but if our country's going to have a useful debate on national security, we have to get beyond the drumbeat of propaganda and get the facts on the table. Over the next few months, you'll be hearing this debate. I'd like you to keep in mind the two simple reasons not to cut defense now. One, it's not cheap. Two, it's not safe. If we listen to those who would abandon our defense program, we will not only jeopardize negotiations with the Soviet Union, we may put peace itself at risk. I said it wouldn't be cheap to cut. How can cutting not be cheap? Well, simple. We tried that in the 70s, and the result was waste, enormous waste. Hundreds of millions of dollars lost because the cost of each plane and tank and ship went up, often way up. The old shopper's adage proved true. They are cheaper by the dozen. Arbitrary cuts only bring phony savings. But there's a more important reason not to abandon our defense program. It's not safe. Almost 25 years ago, when John Kennedy occupied this office, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he commanded the greatest military power on Earth. Today, we Americans must live with a dangerous new reality. Year in and year out, at the expense of its own people, the Soviet leadership has been making a relentless effort to gain military superiority over the United States. Between 1970 and 1985 alone, the Soviets invested $500 billion more than the United States in defense and built nearly three times as many strategic missiles. As a consequence of their enormous weapons investment, major military imbalances still exist between our two countries. Today, the Soviet Union has deployed over 1.5 times as many combat aircraft as the United States, over 2.5 times as many submarines, over 5 times as many tanks, and over 11 times as many artillery pieces. We have begun to close some of these gaps, but if we're to regain our margins of safety, more must be done. Where the Soviets once relied on numbers alone, they now strive for both quantity and quality. We anticipate that over the next 5 years, they will deploy on the order of 40 nuclear submarines, 500 new ballistic missiles, and 18,000 modern tanks. My 5-year defense budget maintains our commitment to America's rebuilding program. And I'm grateful that Secretary Weinberger is here to fight for that program with all the determination and ability he has shown in the past. But my budget does not call for matching these Soviet increases. So one question must be asked. Can we really afford to do less than what I've proposed? Today, we spend a third less of our gross national product on defense than under John Kennedy. Yet some in Congress talk of even deeper cuts. Barely 6% of our nation's gross national product. That's all we invest to keep America free, secure, and at peace. The Soviets invest more than twice as much. But now, strip away spending on salaries, housing, dependents, and the like, and compare. The United States invests on actual weapons and research only 2.6% of our gross national product, while the Soviet Union invests 11% on weapons, more than four times as much. This is the hard, cold reality of our defense deficit. But it's not just the immense Soviet arsenal that puts us on our guard. The record of Soviet behavior, the long history of Soviet brutality toward those who are weaker, reminds us that the only guarantee of peace and freedom is our military strength and our national will. The peoples of Afghanistan and Poland, of Czechoslovakia and Cuba, and so many other captive countries, they understand this. Some argue that our dialogue with the Soviets means we can treat defense more casually. Nothing could be farther from the truth. It was our seriousness about defense that created the climate in which serious talks could finally begin. Now that the Soviets are back at the table, we must not undercut our negotiators. Unfortunately, that's exactly what some members of Congress have done. By banning any U.S. tests of anti-satellite system, Congress not only protected a Soviet monopoly, it unilaterally granted the Soviets a concession they could not win at the bargaining table. So our defense program must rest on these principles. First, we must be smart about what we build. We don't have to copy everything the Soviets do. We don't have to compete on Soviet terms. Our job is to provide for our security by using the strengths of our free society. If we think smart enough, we don't have to think quite so big. We don't have to do the job with large numbers and brute force. We don't have to increase the size of our forces from 2 million to their 5 million, as long as our military men and women have the quality tools they need to keep the peace. We don't have to have as many tanks as the Soviets, as long as we have sophisticated anti-tank weapons. Innovation is our advantage. One example, advances in making airplanes and cruise missiles almost invisible to Soviet radar could neutralize the vast air defense systems upon which the Soviets and some of their most dangerous client states depend. But innovation is not enough. We have to follow through. Blueprints alone don't deter aggression. We have to translate our lead in the lab to a lead in the field. But when our budget is cut, we can't do either. Second, our security assistance provides as much security for the dollar as our own defense budget. Our friends can perform many tasks more cheaply than we can. And that's why I can't understand proposals in Congress to sharply slash this vital tool. Military assistance to friends in strategic regions strengthens those who share our values and interests. And when they are strong, we're strengthened. It is in our interest to help them meet threats that could ultimately bring harm to us as well. Third, where defense reform is needed, we will pursue it. The Packard Commission we created will be reporting in 2 days. We hope they will have ideas for new approaches that give us even better ways to buy our weapons. We're eager for good ideas, for new ideas, America's special genius. Wherever the Commission's recommendations point the way to greater executive effectiveness, I will implement them, even if they run counter to the will of the entrenched bureaucracies and special interests. I will also urge Congress to heed the Commission's report and to remove those obstacles to good management that Congress itself has created over the years. The fourth element of our strategy for the future is to reduce America's dependence on nuclear weapons. You've heard me talk about our Strategic Defense Initiative, the program that could one day free us all from the prison of nuclear terror. It would be pure folly for the United States not to press forward with SDI when the Soviets have already invested up to 20 years on their own program. Let us not forget that the only operational missile defense in the world today guards the capital of the Soviet Union, not the United States. But while SDI offers hope for the future, we have to consider today's world. For too long, we and our allies have permitted nuclear weapons to be a crutch, a way of not having to face up to real defense needs. We must free ourselves from that crutch. Our goal should be to deter, and if necessary, to repel any aggression without a resort to nuclear arms. Here again, technology can provide us with the means not only to respond to full-scale aggression, but to strike back at terrorists without harming innocent civilians. Today's technology makes it possible to destroy a tank column up to 120 miles away without using atomic weapons. This technology may be the first cost-effective conventional defense in post-war history against the giant Red Army. When we fail to equip our troops with these modernized systems, we only increase the risk that we may one day have to resort to nuclear weapons. These are the practical decisions we make when we send a defense budget to Congress. Each generation has to live with the challenges history delivers, and we can't cope with these challenges by evasion. If we sustain our efforts now, we have the best chance in decades of building a secure peace. That's why I met with General Secretary Gorbachev last year, and that's why we're talking to the Soviets today, bargaining if Congress will support us from strength. We want to make this a more peaceful world. We want to reduce arms. We want agreements that truly diminish the nuclear danger. We don't just want signing ceremonies and color photographs of leaders toasting each other with champagne. We want more. We want real agreements, agreements that really work with no cheating. We want an end to state policies of intimidation, threats, and the constant quest for domination. We want real peace. I will never ask for what isn't needed. I will never fight for what isn't necessary. But I need your help. We've come so far together these last 5 years. Let's not falter now. Let's maintain that crucial level of national strength, unity, and purpose that has brought the Soviet Union to the negotiating table and has given us this historic opportunity to achieve real reductions in nuclear weapons and a real chance at lasting peace. That would be the finest legacy we could leave behind for our children and for their children. Thank you. God bless you and good night.
The President of the United States, live from the White House with a broadcast address that he requested to the United States public. Now, CBS News will present a different view in the defense debate shortly, but first a brief review of what President Reagan said in case you came in late or were distracted. The President came out and spoke strongly, both in speaking to the Russians abroad and to the U.S. Congress at home, on the need, as he sees it, to keep up U.S. defense spending, even at a time when other federal budget items, including social programs, are being cut deeply. The President accused Congress of, quote, undercutting U.S. arms control negotiators by banning U.S. anti-satellite tests, and he said congressional cutting of defense spending would be, quote, backsliding the most irresponsible kind. But the President barely glanced over one of the most controversial defense spending items, his request for $100 million, most of it for resumed military aid for the Contra rebels fighting the Sandinistas. Now, in keeping with CBS News policy on matters of public interest, we now present another view, and the Democrats in Congress have selected Jim Wright.
As House Majority Leader, I've been asked to give a congressional perspective on our national defense, our global security, and particularly freedom in our hemisphere, and how we make all this fit into our national budget. There are some facts that we all need to know. In a broader sense, what I have to say will not be partisan. Well, Democrats have supported a strong defense always, and we always will. But there are times when only the President can speak for all of us in the councils of the world. And when he does, we want him to succeed. We've cheered him on as he went to the summit with Mr. Gorbachev. We've supported his position in the Philippines. We oppose military dictatorship and the suppression of political liberties anywhere in the world, and particularly in our hemisphere, whether it be in Nicaragua or Chile. In supporting the success and survival of freedom, there's no such thing as Democrats or Republicans. We're all Americans. Now, we do have some fundamental differences over spending priorities and the amount of debt that we're willing to place on the backs of our children. We think the deficits themselves pose a danger to our national security. We know that it adds to the debt to double military spending and cut taxes at the same time. We believe even the Pentagon should be held to strict standards of accountability in spending taxpayers' money. And we believe that true national security depends on a lot of things in addition to just military weapons. Let's consider for a minute just how much we've already spent on defense. In the past 5 years, bipartisan majorities in Congress have doubled the rate of military spending from $146 billion in 1980 to $292 billion this year. This is the most massive military spending buildup that the nation has ever undertaken in peacetime. Unfortunately, force feeding sometimes results in waste. We're spending twice as much on missiles, getting only 16% more missiles, for example. But today, the United States and the Soviet Union together have 60,000 nuclear warheads with a total destructive capacity more than 1 million times that of the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. We have enough weapons to kill each other off 8 or 10 times over. Most authorities agree that the United States enjoys strategic parity, if not strategic superiority. Let's get one thing real clear. Nobody has suggested that we cut our defense. The only question is how much we can afford prudently to add. If Congress were simply to rubber stamp the president's entire Pentagon budget, you know, we'd be spending almost 4 times as much on the military by the end of this decade as the nation spent during the height of the Vietnam War. Now, frankly, it just simply isn't possible to do this and rule out any new revenues and balance the budget. Republican leaders know that. Let's look at what's happening right here at home. While borrowing to finance this unprecedented buildup in arms, the administration demands that we reduce our investment in education. We cut Medicare and Medicaid, cut job training for displaced workers, reduce clean air and clean water programs, law enforcement programs, retirement benefits, GI Bill of Rights for Vietnam veterans, well, a whole gamut of domestic government on which people depend. The Congress has cut discretionary domestic spending by 34%. But in spite of that, the deficit soars out of control. Look, here's the staggering fact. In the short 5 years of this administration, as much has been added to the national debt as our ancestors added in the entire 192 years of our previous history, from George Washington to Jimmy Carter. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. President Truman conducted the entire Korean War without adding to the national debt. We paid as we went. Even during the costly Vietnam War, we didn't pile up massive debts for our children to pay. Why must we do that in peacetime? The American people are willing to pay for the necessary level of defense. Well, they don't want to pay for more defense than we get. The celebrated cases of the $400 hammers and the $7,600 coffee pots unearthed by congressional committees, well, they're atypical, thank God. But there shouldn't be any such examples of glaring waste. And the American people know, too, that real national security depends on certain other things, equally as important to the country's future as armaments and weapons. It depends, first of all, on education, the brain power of our citizens. 3 years ago, the president's own commission on education reported on what it called a nation at risk. And here's what it said. If an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose on America the mediocre educational performance that exists today, we might well have viewed it as an act of war. And yet, 3 years later, the president's budget asks that we zero out the GI Bill of Rights for our Vietnam veterans, that we cut student loans and work-study grants, which make it possible for young Americans of modest means to get an education. Now, we think that's a misplaced priority. Last year, Japan, with only half our population, graduated 50% more scientists and engineers than we did. And people wonder why we're losing out in trade? Having just become a debtor nation for the first time in 72 years, we need a trade policy to restore our industrial base. Most certainly, our relations with other nations in this hemisphere constitute an indispensable element in our national security. Now, we worry about communism. We don't seem to worry much about the conditions that breed communism. Even if we didn't have to worry about the problems of Cuba and Nicaragua, there still would be challenges that would stagger us in Latin America. The problems of Latin America are the problems of illiteracy and malnutrition and disease, the problems of joblessness and a bondage of debt that amounts almost to servitude, and a growing sense of hopeless disillusionment with society. This is the stuff of which the Castros and the Ortegas are made. In the last century, patriots like Bolivar and San Martin patterned their popular people's movements after us. We were the inspiration and the example. We have a residue of goodwill if we'll build upon it. Throughout Latin America, plain people cherish the memory of three American presidents: Abraham Lincoln, who freed the slaves; Franklin D. Roosevelt, who withdrew United States troops from Latin America and declared a good neighbor policy; and John F. Kennedy, who inspired hopes of economic betterment for the average people through his short-lived Alliance for Progress. If we would reap the respect of our neighbors throughout the world, and particularly to the South, we'd have to cultivate a sustained interest in them as people and their very real problems. Not just that of a fire engine that rushes in to put out a fire and then rushes out just as swiftly. To ignore the combustibles that lie everywhere upon the tattered landscape of a civilization cruelly battered by a history of neglect. They have a saying down south of the border: la mejor manera de conseguir una amistad es ser amigable. The way to have a friend is to be a friend. In seeking a policy for Latin America, and by extension for the rest of the world, that may be as good a starting place as any. Thank you for listening. Good night.
Congressman Jim Wright of Texas, who was selected by the Democrats to give another view on the continuing debate about the defense of the United States, that presented in keeping with the longstanding CBS News policy under such circumstances as we had tonight, when the president speaks, whether it be a Republican or Democratic president, to allow the other party time to speak behind him and present another view. And so tonight, two views presented in the long-running complicated debate over our nation's defense.